From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you're talking about sharks, you're talking about one of the most successful species that ever existed on this planet. Take the average species. The average species exists for about 6 million years. But the shark is way above average. These creatures are older than the dinosaurs. For millions and millions and millions of years, they've been able to keep moving and survive. It's unclear how exactly. Scientists are now just coming to understand their behavior and their biology, but somehow through ice ages and cataclysmic asteroid strikes, they've kept at it. Until now. The threat of overfishing, the uncertainty of climate change may actually be too much for the shark. Today in the program, we're talking about sharks. Our guest is the environmental reporter Juliet Eilprin. She's written a book that explores the mystery of the shark. It's called Demon Fish. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Talk about your successful species. Sharks are one of the oldest living species that has ever existed on this planet. In her book on sharks, Juliet Eilprin quotes the Stanford marine biologist Stephen Palumbi, who said that sharks were around before almost everything, and it was probably pretty lonely for them when they were king. Sharks are way older than the dinosaurs. Eilprin says they were swimming in our seas before the continents took shape. The secret to their longevity may be the thing that scares so many of us about sharks, their incredible gifts as predators. Eilprin says that their murderous power, along with an ancient lineage, has given sharks a place within human culture where they are worshipped but also loathed. Eilprin has written a book that explores the mystery of the shark. It's called Demon Fish, travels through the hidden world of sharks. And today in the program, she's joining us to talk about it. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. Juliet Eilprin is the national environmental reporter for The Washington Post. She's covered issues ranging from climate change to the 2008 presidential campaign for the Post. She's also the author of the book Fight Club Politics, and she's joining us today from the studios of The Washington Post in Washington. And Juliet Eilprin, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Doug.
Well, I wanted to ask about, I guess let's start with your first encounter. First real encounter with sharks.
Right.
It wasn't that long ago. 2005, I think you say in the book. And this was off the shores of this small island of Bimini. Is that the first time?
That's absolutely right. There was a scientist. I had been covering the environment for about a year for the Post. And there was a scientist who basically snookered me into going there. She said, look, you know, if you want to get in the water with sharks and see what's really going on, you know, all we have to do is fly to Miami. Then it's another 20-minute plane ride and I can get you in the water. And so it was really almost on a lark that I decided to go. And I just didn't have many expectations of what it would be like. I just kind of thought, oh, this will be an interesting story. I'm going to look at what's happening with the marine world and possible threats to sharks and other creatures. And so it actually came as a surprise once I got in the water to really see sharks firsthand and see both how beautiful they are and, of course, how scary they can be at the first moment you enter their turf.
Well, so what's it like? I mean, It's got to be scary. I mean, right? It's got to be
right.
Scary.
I was exactly. I mean, yeah. I feel like if you're not scared, something's going wrong. So I was definitely. And part of what was hilarious was I was, of course, terrified before getting in the water because I had never done something like this. And I was surrounded by a bunch of marine biologists where that's all in a day's work. So they were incredibly casual about it. So then it makes you feel even more stupid. But, you know, you're still going to be scared.
Right.
And so then what's funny is I said, OK, I've just got to put on a facade and pretend that this is no big deal and jump in the water. I was snorkeling. Yeah. I was really struck by two things. One, how uncoordinated everything was. There were sharks coming. There was, of course, bloody barracuda that the top scientist, Samuel Gruber, had put in the water for them. And so first, you had sharks coming from all different directions. So it immediately kind of defied my expectation of this idea of, you know, either you're going to see one shark by itself or you're going to see schools of fish. And so, you know, they were kind of coming from everywhere. And that was amazing. But also just to see how gorgeous they were and how beautifully designed they were was really the thing that I was struck by the first time I was in the water with them.
So I wanted to ask you, because I want to talk about how it seems like our feelings toward sharks are really complicated. I mentioned in the beginning, you talked about how there's this kind of we've worshipped them over time, yet we've also loathed them over time. Right. What is that about, do you think, in its essence?
I think it all speaks to the fact that we recognize that they have power, and of course, the way that you alluded to, that what's made them incredible and made them survivors are their predatory skills, which are really unrivaled. And so what I think is really interesting is that historically, if you look at ancient cultures, they saw them as having power in a nuanced way. Sometimes they act for good, sometimes they act for evil. You know, they're kind of meting out justice the way they see fit. And then, of course, in modern day America, we've come to just see them as this ever-present threat that's out to get us. But in all cases, it's really recognizing that there's something extraordinary about these creatures.
You say that you began to see how sharks' lives reveal the life of the ocean. Like there's this relationship between their lives and the broader life of the vast ocean.
Right. As the top predators, they really occupy a fairly unique role because they're help keeping mid-level predators in check. And one thing I think is so fascinating is sometimes they can affect an ecosystem because, you know, they do the obvious thing. Maybe they eat, you know, the species that are just a little lower down on the food chain. But one thing that's incredible is there are scientists who have found that some animals are just scared of, say, sleeper sharks being around in seagrass habitat. So they just won't overgraze this area, not because, you know, not because they're being eaten, but because they're scared of being eaten. So that idea that they even play a psychological role in the ocean is a pretty amazing thing.
Well, and we'll make this connection a little bit more as we go along, but it's like a predator species on the savannah. It's like a predator species in the Rockies, like the wolves. I mean, you make this connection in the book that they're critical to the health of that ecosystem.
Right. And I think, and again, obviously, listeners in the West are really aware of this, that, you know, we have an uneasy relationship with some of the top predators on land because we see them as being, you know, whether they're a threat to us or our livestock or our pets. And I think it's hard to say, how do you deal with wildness? How do you deal with these really key animals when they also instill fear in you?
Mm. Okay, what does Shark Week on cable television reveal about our understanding about our relationship to sharks? I mean, you would have figured after time that we would stop seeing them as these terrifying creatures. I mean, you know, you see all these. There are plenty of shows about how they're not these terrible creatures who are after humans that we thought they were. But this, it seems like this myth just persists.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, again, as you're saying, what I think is incredible is not just that you have a successful cable show about sharks, because of course you do, but that it's, you know, been running for almost a quarter of a century and it still attracts roughly 30 million viewers each week.
Yeah.
There, you know, so that in itself is really interesting and compelling. I mean, I think, you know, again, it's fascinating because we're, you know, it's obviously in some ways like watching a, you know, a car accident, how traffic slows down. We say that we can't bear to see it, but everyone has to turn and look. And I think particularly with Shark Week, there's something about you want to see the attack, but you also want the story of people who survived. For some reason, you know, that also plays into our psyche, that even as we're, you know, convinced that they're going to get us, you at least want, you know, some hope that you'll be able to survive it, which in fact is accurate. You know, you have a 90% chance of surviving a shark attack. But it's amazing that we, you know, year after year, people still tune in and in great numbers.
You talk about in the book how human beings, that regardless of culture or of the era or of geographic location, that we've always been fascinated with sharks. And is it just because of the fact that we were afraid of them that they have this power, or is there something else going on? I mean, because they take roles in rituals and myths throughout history.
Right. I think part of it, I mean, what's interesting is, I mean, I certainly think at base there's just this primal fear, and it's not only of being struck by a shark, but the idea that it can come without warning, that it is inherently a mysterious. So I think that's part of what, explains why you see it in so many cultures. I do think when you look at some of the older faith traditions that, you know, they did have some actual interactions with them, and then somehow through that developed a way of understanding their world. And so, for example, when I spent time in Papua New Guinea with folks who have a tradition, they used it as a way to connect to their ancestors, I think partially because they recognized these were ancient creatures and wanted to see how they could help inform their view of the ocean, which they were connected to but didn't fully understand.
Well, let's talk more about your experience in Papua New Guinea, the shark callers.
Right.
Tell us, first of all, Salam Karasimbe.
Karasimbe, exactly.
Yeah. He's a great character, I have to say, in the book.
Thank you.
For this part of Papua New Guinea, sharks are an important part of their creation. Myth.
Right. It's an integral part that essentially they have a god similar to how you would think of a Christian god. They called it Moroa. And in their storytelling, what's very funny is that their god Moroa created the shark, and the shark swam away before Moroa could fully brief the animal on what it had to do. And so he said, all right, well, you know, you weren't willing to listen to my lecture, so that way, you know, as a result, you're going to get caught by humans from time to time, which I like. I like that kind of almost chastising the shark for its impatience. And what's so interesting is that they have these very, you know, they have these extremely elaborate rituals and traditions that involve all these preparations you have to make before you go out to sea to do this extraordinary thing, which is essentially to engage in hand-to-hand combat with a shark. For the sake of your village. But again, what's so interesting is it's not just about bringing back the shark for a feast, which is, of course, what happens, but just this idea that your ability to draw upon the shark and have the shark come to you in many ways is a way that your ancestors are connected to you and are helping to give you a sense of, you know, what's going on in the afterlife. And that, I thought, was really intriguing.
Well, they observe these very strict dietary restrictions. There
right.
are particular rules they have to go through. It's interesting how they divide up the sharks that they catch in terms of their temperament, I guess. It's very fierce.
Yeah, fierce. You know, I'm trying to think. There are a few different ones, including, you know, more friendly. But I think that's actually a really smart way to divide up sharks, right? Better to put them in the very fierce, moderate level than you know, the categories that we sometimes use. I mean, of course, they have morphological and genetic implications. But I think when you're dealing with engaging with a shark, kind of what their temperament is like is probably the most important category that you need.
Well, so how does it work? Just say something about that.
Sure. So what they do is they have this wooden noose contraption, which only is used basically in this part of the world. And so what they do, they take a coconut rattle and they shake it both above the water, underneath the water, and hit it against a single, they have a one-person canoe. And the sense that actually both scientists and the shark callers themselves will say is that the sound of the rattle, you know, particularly underwater, could mimic the sound of a school of fish in trouble. So that lures the shark in. And then at that point, they have a wooden contraption with rope that essentially the shark would swim in. They would put it around the shark's head, and so they would essentially both use it to strangle and kind of tire out the shark and contain it. And then rather than using, say, a hook and line, which you might expect for catching a shark, and then at that point, once the shark is exhausted enough, they would club it in the head, and that way they would be able to bring it on board the canoe and then bring it back to shore.
It's interesting how Karasimbe says he does it, why he does it. He says that he told you that he feels something in his body and in his heart. And I have to say, it sort of gets at, because you write about the fact that ancient myths about sharks, and I think maybe even practices like in Papua New Guinea are interesting because they show, you say, how the animals have changed over time. Not how the animals have changed over time, but how we've changed, how
right.
we used to be closer
right.
to sharks in the natural world.
Right. And yeah, I mean, just, I mean, the one thing that's so amazing about Salam Karasimbe, who, you know, can't tell me how old he is, but it's probably, you know, in his 60s, 70s, somewhere there, is just, you know, the confidence that he has and the connection that he feels to the sea, and that he feels like this is, and many Papua New Guineans in this area I talk to feel like this is what makes them special, that they do understand and can master this powerful animal. And again, what I think is so interesting is that you know, it really does give you the sense that in some ways it was like going back in time. And while these animals have been, you know, operating the way they've been operating for millions of years, it gives you a glimpse into how we might have viewed them differently than, you know, how they're treated today.
How far back can we read stories in human civilization about sharks?
That's a great question. I certainly found, for example, artistic representations going back several thousand years, you know, going back to, say, 3000 BC. That was about as far back as I had traced it. One thing that's so interesting with these oral traditions that you're talking about, whether you're talking about Papua New Guinea or perhaps Hawaiians have really detailed folklore, you know, how far that goes back, who knows? But certainly as far back as 3000 BC, you begin to see, you know, images of them. And then, you know, as you move forward, kind of, you know, written accounts of how, you know, whether they're talking about mythical representations or actual representations of sharks.
You say there's this theme of this connection that comes across a lot of these shark worshiping cultures where the shark is, well, you describe it as kind of akin to a mafia godfather.
Right, right.
Like they're picking winners and losers in these societies?
Yeah, and I thought, you know, I actually think it's a pretty reasonable way to look at it. What you know, what's interesting about that is part of the message that you know, seems interesting is it's a message of treat this creature with respect.
Yeah.
Because if you do right by this creature, then you're going to have it on your side. And so what you see again over and over again in a lot of these cultures, again, the Hawaiians, for example, have amakua. These kind of, what's interesting is they're the kind of lower down shark deities, but they really were allied with individual families. And so there were, in you know, some cases, a little larger, say, villages. But it's the idea that if you pay homage to them, if you look out for them, then, you know, A, maybe they'll make sure that your neighbor is badly off, or also, you know, they'll make sure that you get an adequate fish catch. And so I like that idea that it was an interesting way. And you know, can also see it in some river cultures in Africa as well, this idea, pay the shark respect, and that's your best hope of emerging unscathed.
So the book, you talk about it being this attempt to kind of get at the mystery surrounding the shark,
right?
Do you figure, after all of this, and we're going to talk about all the particulars that we can, but do you think you understand that mystery better, or is there still something there that is kind of elusive about the shark?
I definitely think there are parts of sharks that elude me to this day. I definitely have a sense that I know them better, and I can, of course, give you more detailed scientific assessments than I would have known before I started researching it. But I love, in a certain sense, the idea that you can try to capture what they're all about, but you know, there are limits to what we can do, particularly because they are, by their own nature, elusive and hard to pin down. And I think that's a good thing. It's not necessarily a terrible thing.
Juliet Alperin is with us. Her book is called Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about sharks. There's a reason we're afraid of them. They are one of the world's most perfectly designed predators. But really, it's the shark that ought to be afraid. Humans are far more dangerous. We kill between 80 and 100 million sharks a year. The environmental reporter Juliet Alperin is joining us today to put that number in perspective, to offer some understanding about sharks. She has a book that she's written. It's called Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. We invite you to join the conversation if you like. If you have questions or comments, 801-585-WEST. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. Juliet, the story is also about, in many ways, how globalization has changed everything you say in the book, how science is transforming our understanding of the sea and of the threat. But I have to say, it's kind of interesting that the science of sharks, you know, revelations about their behavior and their habitat, in some ways is just beginning to emerge, it seems, that we're just now coming to understand them in some ways.
Absolutely. And I think that that reflects two things. One, it obviously reflects some advances in technology. Before you had satellite tags, for example, that could give you a precise sense of how sharks and other marine creatures were traveling, underwater over extended period of time. You know, we just didn't have a sense of what their migrations were like and where they were going and how they were operating. So one is you're definitely having these technological innovations that are helping answer questions. But the other one, which is so interesting, is despite the fact that, again, we've been so obsessed with sharks, because they lacked a commercial value, they weren't really an intense topic of and subject of scientific research. And even to this day, I'm amazed by the relatively small number of shark specialists you have globally. I mean, you're talking about a couple hundred people who are dedicating their careers to sharks, which is pretty small when you consider, you know, how many scientists are out there and how many sharks are out there.
Well, so let's go through some basics. I mean, I guess it's fairly obvious, although not everyone understands, that we're talking about a fish. It's a fish. It's a special kind of fish, though, of course.
Exactly. It's a cartilaginous fish. So that's always important to mention that. So instead of the bony fish that we often think of that have bony skeletons, sharks have cartilage. And that's one of the reasons they're attractive commercially now. But it's also something that, you know, again, makes them so unusual in how they operate and that they don't have, for example, the same swim bladder as other fish that you think of. And so these are, you know, some of the and in some of the ways that they operate, they might seem a little bit more like mammals, but they are fish.
And it's kind of extraordinary how they're built. They maybe most people understand this, but they have to keep, most of them anyway, have to keep moving.
Yeah, many of them have to keep moving, but, you know, in order to get the oxygen, the water flowing over their gills to provide them with oxygen. There are ones that don't have to, but many do. This is called ram ventilation, and it's part of what makes them so scary and also gave rise to, you know, Woody Allen's famous line in Annie Hall when he's explaining how their relationship isn't working. He said it's like a shark that, you know, has to keep on moving. What we have on our hands is a dead shark. So, you know, it's really, that's probably the best, tutelage of shark biology that people have gotten in recent decades, I would say.
Well, it kind of explains, it made me wonder, like, if you had any concerns about the image on your book, because how else can you convey a shark, except for some of these sharks anyway, in a scary way? They open their mouths when they're moving, and this looks, it's not a ferocious, but in some ways it's almost always ferocious looking in some ways, right?
Right. And it is. And part of what I try to do, it's very funny because some people then, you know, turn around and say, so should we be hugging sharks and should we be doing all this? And it's a tough message to convey. But what I am trying to say is, look, they're not warm and fuzzy like penguins. No. You know, you're not going to end up thinking this is something you want necessarily in your home or, you know, being your kid's best friend. But that said, they're just so incredible on their own terms. And that's how you have to take sharks on their own terms, even when there are elements that are scary about them.
Their skin is remarkable.
Yeah, I have to say I love that they have the skin teeth called denticles. And, you know, while the shape of them and the angle in which they're positioned vary depending on sharks, what it does allow them to do, you know, when you sometimes if people felt shark skin, it's smooth on one if you rub it one way and then it's rough in the other. And that's because they really channel currents of water so they can move faster through the water by using this enamel covered skin. And I just think that's really incredible.
And the fact that they've been so successful as a species for hundreds of millions of years makes it surprising that they reproduce quite slowly. I mean, they're not exactly prolific.
Right, exactly. And that's, of course, one of their great vulnerabilities. They haven't had to reproduce. I mean, this is one of those fascinating evolutionary lessons, which is that they didn't have to produce in enormous numbers because they were so intimidating to other species that they didn't have to worry about tons of their young being picked off. But that said, what you do see is that they many times take decades to mature sexually. And then once they do, they might, you know, give birth to one pup, a couple pups at a time. You're really often not talking about many offspring. And as a result, they're much more sensitive to fishing pressure.
So the secret to their success, I mean, they've been able to survive millions and millions. That is it just that they're great predators, or is there something else we're not understanding maybe?
You know, that's a great question. I would say primarily it's just that they're great predators. Yeah. I mean, the fact that they can do that so well and that they're, you know, in many ways unrivaled. I mean, you know, in the ocean for their dominance. That's really what it comes down to. But, you know, I think you raise a good question, which is, I think, one of the really interesting things is, you know, are there things that we just don't know about sharks yet that might explain things later on that easily could come up? But you know, from what we know, it's really this ability that they have to hunt like very few other creatures in the ocean.
And incredibly ruthless. I think you point out that some species eat each other in utero.
Right. I was going to mention when we were talking about the shark reproduction, I was going to say they don't do themselves any favor if you're going to eat your siblings in utero, right? That's going to cut down on the number of sharks that are born. But it's amazing. Sand tiger sharks do this, and this has been well documented, and, you know, it very well could happen in other species as well, that for example, you know, with certain species like that, the sand tiger has two uteruses, but it will only produce two pups at a time because the one inside an individual uterus will, you know, eat all his or her siblings. And that allows them to be born as an experienced killer and predator that can then survive in the outside world.
One thing that seems to have surprised you, and I have to say surprised me a bit, is how much closer sharks are than you imagined or than I thought as well. They're, you know, because I guess you see them as being way, way, way out there, incredibly elusive, but they're really closer to us than we thought.
Right. And that is really one of the revelations that we've realized in recent years due to technology, that what's incredible in it, this is whether you're talking about, say, the coast of California or you're talking about South Africa or what have you, we're now able to recognize that sharks are actually in the waters close to shore, you know, because they're feeding the way many other creatures are feeding, you know, for extended periods of time in a way that we wouldn't anticipate. And so, you know, on one level, you could say, oh, well, it makes sense that we're so terrified of being struck by a shark. But the other way to look at it is they've actually been there in the water all along. We just have been oblivious to it. And I do think, you know, the fact that we're now capable of saying that great whites are congregating off central California for months at a time is something that we just literally didn't know a few years ago.
You mentioned in the book that sharks matter not because we can see ourselves in them.
Right.
They matter because they exist apart from us. And I wanted to ask you about this quote that you include from the writer and naturalist Henry Beston. He says, "They are other nations caught with ourselves in the net of life and time."
I'm so glad that's actually my favorite, in many ways, my favorite quote. So I'm so glad you read it. What's so interesting about that is that, you know, again, that's to the best of my ability, what I was trying to convey is this idea that we shouldn't want them around because they're like us, because we see ourselves in them the way, again, we might see a penguin who's nursing its egg or something like that. We should want them around because they're different. And because, you know, I actually describe myself as I was reporting out this book as a foreign correspondent. Mm-hmm. I was trying to learn about what I consider, for lack of a better term, a separate nation that operates according to different principles, has different skills and technology than we do, but, you know, is really interesting and valuable in its own right. And so I think that's what I'm trying to get people to wrap their heads around if they can.
Mm. But then there's also this idea that you mentioned later in the book, this kind of powerful image and kind of connection that sharks are our ancestors. I mean, quite
right.
Literally our physical evolutionary ancestors.
And that is something I have to say that was probably the, you know, if not the biggest surprise while reporting out this book. It was, you know, one of the top ones, along with the idea that they're so close to shore much of the time. So, you know, I did not know until I was looking into this idea that the muscles that we use to chew and to talk, the bones in our inner ear, that these are actually descended from sharks. And it's really interesting sometimes if you talk to scientists, they say, you know, people are just getting comfortable with the idea that we're related to primates. If you tell people we're related to sharks, the fish, you know, you've kind of lost them. We don't actually circulate this that much in terms of the information. So, but I think, you know, that's what brought it back to me, you know, brought me around to Salam Karasimbe and what he's doing. He's not off base when he looks at sharks as a connection to his ancestors.
When did, I guess we've always been afraid of sharks, I suppose, but when did the kind of modern fear about sharks really sort of come around? I mean, I keep thinking about Jaws,
right,
which scared the devil out of all kinds of people in the 70s. But
absolutely.
You also write about the series of attacks, which I guess even inspired the book in
1916.
Yeah, talk about that.
Exactly. So that was a series of attacks off the New Jersey shore. It's worth noting that in nearly 100 years since then, there's only been one fatal shark attack off New Jersey. So it's not really a hot spot, but it certainly was at the turn of the century. It was, you know, people were just beginning to go to the beach for recreation. It was seen as this thing that, you know, was desirable. And there were four people killed within 12 days. And to this day, it's a little unclear. Was it one shark? Was it multiple sharks? But it really terrified Americans. Before then, there had been fear of sharks, but it had been restricted to seafarers. You know, really, when we started worrying about sharks again was in the late 1500s, 1600s, people started going to sea, and you certainly had incidents involving sharks. But when this happened, and when average Americans were actually killed by sharks, that really instilled terror. And in fact, you know, President Woodrow Wilson held a cabinet meeting about it. I mean, imagine, wow. This was really in many ways a national crisis, which they didn't understand. And so, and simultaneously, you know, that went on. And then you had a series of attacks off South Africa and off Australia at the same time. And so I think that was the moment when everyday humans thought, you know, the average man or woman thought, I might be wanting to go to the beach for a good time and I might fall prey to a shark.
Mm. So we talked about, and I mentioned this, that we've worshipped them over time, but we've also hated them over time. And you say this is the thing that's helping to, you know, propel their rapid decline.
Right.
And so I wanted to ask you about that. I get the part that that we're overfishing them. That
right.
You know that, and I want to talk about the shark fin trade and all that. But so I get the idea that sharks are being, you know, fished for
right.
food and that kind of thing. But is there fear also part of the reason they're being is there something else going on, or we
yes.
all do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Yeah.
So basically they're being fished for their status and their image. That's what I'm arguing in the book, that my sense is, you know, there are other reasons. There's the texture of the cartilage is certainly desirable from an Asian perspective in some ways. But the fact of the matter is, if we didn't think sharks were so incredible and so powerful, we wouldn't want them as badly as we do for a commodity, because to serve them connotes status, and to fish them on a charter boat even off of Miami is status. And so that's part of what I think is propelling their decline.
Okay, so let's talk about your experience tasting shark fin soup.
Sure.
Because this sort of gets at, like, what is the big deal? Like, it's not delicious. Right? Or is it?
Right.
I mean,
right. You know, what it comes down to, the actual noodle that's created from yeah. what they call a needle in the shark fin.
Well, it's a noodle.
It's a noodle
wow.
in the soup. And so it's flavorless. That's what's so stunning, that the soup itself is perfectly tasty. Basically, when I interviewed restaurateurs in China, they said, look, we have to add chicken and pork and all these spices. So sure, you put enough of that in there, you're going to get a decent soup. But
yeah,
what
but
I
that's
found,
broth, right?
Yeah, that's the broth.
Yeah.
That's the broth. It's not this, the fact that this little, and it's a tiny noodle. I can't even explain to you. You know, it's much smaller than, you know, it's not as long as my pinky. It's probably, you know, half the length of my pinky and a fraction as thick. And the fact that just having this noodle in the soup is so critical when it actually is adding nothing of culinary value, I found that shocking. Now, I'm also thinking maybe it's a way to lead us out of this mess, because, you know, perhaps you can get people to think of it differently because it's not delicious like some other foods. But it's fascinating to me.
But that has to make you angry, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's when you think of it, it's a shocking waste, really. You know, the idea that you're hunting these creatures, both, you know, frankly, to gyp your customers, because you're not even going to give them that much of it, because, you know, you're trying to maximize your money.
Mm.
But also the idea that, you know, to really give nothing from a culinary perspective, it's you know, it's incredible.
So we should explain that this is the greatest threat to sharks, the shark fin trade.
It's definitely one of the top threats. It's one thing that's very difficult to tell. It's the most obvious threat.
Yeah,
one thing that's hard is that so many sharks are caught by accident, what they call bycatch,
right.
when fishing vessels are targeting for tuna and swordfish, that, you know, in terms of numbers, but, you know, it's a little unclear, but I think that there's, you know, close to a consensus that shark fin soup and the trade of shark fins, it's certainly the economic driver that's leading to the intentional catch of sharks worldwide.
73 million.
Is that the number? Now, one thing that's really interesting is there's a wide range of estimates. So it's anywhere from 26 million to 73 million.
Right.
And one of the things that scientists are trying to do right now is get the more up-to-date figures on that and try to penetrate this pretty shadowy trade and figure out exactly how many sharks are being caught to supply it.
Well, this idea of not knowing gets at one way you described the shark fin auction that you actually observed. Fast and secretive is how you describe
right.
it.
Right. I mean, I was able to witness a shark fin auction in Hong Kong, which is where 80% of shark fins worldwide pass through at some point, even though they're often headed to, say, mainland China or, you know, sometimes, you know, elsewhere in the world. And, you know, it's incredible. I've been to auctions before, everything from I've seen cattle auctions, I've seen charity auctions, things like that. And this one took place so quickly, it spread through, you know, people came through word of mouth and you know, you don't actually even, there's just the clicking of the abacus is going on as different people are entering their bids by whispering in the ear of the assistant to the auctioneer. So it's really unlike any other, you know, process I've ever seen involving trade.
So we're talking all kinds of fins, I guess, the pectorals and the dorsals and the, is that right?
Right, exactly. Well, you know, those are generally, it's basically pectoral, dorsal, and caudal fins that all mix together. Obviously, you know, some are bigger, and so, you know, it depends. But that's what's, you know, what's amazing is they just dump these gray fins, dried fins, on the floor, on this white floor. And, you know, you just don't even have a clear idea of what species you're talking about. It's just, you know, they're there, and they're going to take out the needles to make soup. And, you know, it's just they're kind of looking at it as, you know, how much bang for my buck can I get with any sack of fins that are being dumped on the floor?
And it sounds pretty brutal to get them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're, you know, essentially, you know, at some point you're just slicing them off. Now, you know, it's interesting. A lot of the public outcry has been, are you slicing off, you know, sharks to, you know, sharks while they're alive to get the fins? It's a little unclear, you know, how often that's done, but there's just no question. You know, for example, when I went to Baja California in Mexico, it was the fact that essentially the Mexican fishermen had laid out these long lines. So essentially, you know, dozens of sharks had died on the line overnight. They haul them back in and they start slicing away because they know that the fins are worth 100 times the value of the meat. And so they still are selling the meat, in fact, but they know that the way they're going to get their money is by selling those fins for shark's fin soup.
There's this image. I wanted to read this that you had written in Hong Kong, saying that you say that this isn't fine art that they plan to furnish their homes with or livestock that they'll devote months to raising. It is a heap of desiccated objects that they will seek to transfer to someone else as soon as they acquire it.
Yeah. And so I guess, you know, part of what I was trying to get across in that is just this idea that it's just a business and that to them, they have, you know, these are the people who in some ways are most closely connected, but are the most dispassionate about these animals that once existed in whole. And to them, it's kind of a cog in a machine. It's a widget that they also has no actual value to them except for how they can sell it to the next restaurateur that's going to serve it to his or her guests.
Juliet Eilprin is with us. Her book is called Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Juliet Eilprin. We're talking about her book, Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. Our number, 801-585-WEST. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call from Carrie, who's been waiting in Tooele, Utah. Carrie, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Love your show.
Thank you.
I've had the privilege to dive with these creatures, beautiful creatures, a lot of times, scuba dive and snorkel and whatnot. Many of them, I was on Johnston Island for some years in the late 90s and early 2000s. But the particular experience that was just so amazing was one day, I don't quite remember, but I think we weren't allowed to scuba dive a certain day, but we had the day off. And so we did kind of a funny thing where we wore our mask and snorkels and held onto a ski rope, and the boat, like a ski boat would drive us over a high distance, over a reef, such that we weren't impacting it at all, but we were just able to look down and see the phenomenal creatures and things below. And what was so amazing is that there were two sharks, probably black-tip sharks, because those are the ones that were always around, one maybe about 4 feet, one maybe about 3 feet, who basically thought we looked interesting. We think they were also enticed by the color of the handle of the ski rope. And they just, while we were going through the water fast, being pulled through the water faster than we could hardly stand it, and if we turned our heads, our mouth would blow off or be forced off. The sharks, of course, barely were, you know, it was effortless for them at that speed. And it was just a real testament to how incredible they are, how incredibly fast, how they're just so, so amazing in the water. And anyway, we were around them enough that they were just blasé. We were always looking for other things like eagle rays or whatever. But
yeah, well, Julia, you must have felt that way with seeing them, that, like, how effortless it seems.
Absolutely. And in fact, to some extent, I had a you know, somewhat similar experience where at one point when I was swimming with whale sharks off the Yucatan, at one point I thought, oh, I'll get in behind the shark and I'll just swim along with it, and realize, you know, the shark would leave me in the dust, you know. That, and so finally the only way I solved this was by jumping in the front end, and the shark was coming head towards me, this you know, a fish the size of a school bus, and I realized that I needed to duck out of the way or I'd be in trouble. But I think, you know, that's a great example of just, you know, it's not just that they have these abilities, but it looks so effortless that they just, you know, they're like Ginger Rogers dancing backwards in heels, you know. There's something incredible about it.
Carrie, thanks.
Thanks.
801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. Well, whale shark sort of takes us, I think, to the part of the book where you're talking about sharks as ecotourism, as trying to look at sharks as a different kind of commodity. Let's talk about Mexico, because you say, like in a lot of places, I guess, that shark fishing in Mexico is a matter of economics. It's also a matter of tradition. But you say that in Mexico, like a few other countries, there's this crossroads where we are when it comes to our relationship to sharks.
There's the past
and the future, I guess.
Right. And so I think what's really interesting about this future, which is yet to be written, but, you know, we're in the process of writing it right now, is that there are communities like Isla Holbosch, the sleepy island I went to, you know, a couple hours from Cancun, where it's a former fishing village, which now it's, you know, its economy is basically based on whale shark ecotourism. Mm. It's based on the fact that people will come to this village at certain points of times of year, basically in the summer from, you know, from June to September. They have these major aggregations of whale sharks and people. And one thing that's interesting is it's very well regulated. So there are not something like a million boats in the water. You know, they have permits. You're only allowed to snorkel. You're not allowed to scuba dive to try to minimize the impact on the whale sharks. But you can go out and see these incredible creatures that pose no threat to you because they're filter feeders, you know, on your for yourself. And I think that's really what's interesting is there are a number of studies that have even come out since my manuscript was done, showing that, you know, a single shark can be worth nearly $2 million in terms of the amount of dive and snorkeling tourism that they bring in over the course of their lifetime.
Wow.
And those kinds of numbers obviously are very significant for particularly the developing countries that are working on building up this kind of tourism.
There's a person you write about, Luis Munoz, in Mexico. I wanted you to say something about him because he has this kind of wisdom about fishing and this deep connection to sharks.
Exactly.
And he seems like one of those sort of hopes for the future in terms of trying to transform the way we're thinking about sharks.
Absolutely. So Luis Munoz, whose nickname is Mele, is this wonderful, wonderful former shark fisherman. He's on the other side of Mexico in Baja. I spent time with him where we're still fishing sharks is, you know, how people make their money. And what's so interesting is even though, you know, he kind of points to things like his truck and said, sharks paid for this. They paid for my house, you know, all these things. But, you know, what he's arguing is that he began to see that sharks were not as plentiful, and that he and his colleagues had to go further and further out to fish, and they were spending more money on fuel and getting less getting fewer sharks. And so what he's in the part, he's teamed up with a conservation group there, Imanio Oceanica, and what he's trying to do is convince his fellow, you know, fishermen who are all part of a cooperative that they would be better off building some tourist facilities and having people see the same kind of whale sharks that are off the Yucatan pass through off Baja. And you know, it's so interesting because it's one thing I found fascinating is he tried to convince his own sons not to go into fishing, but they went into fishing anyway. So, you know, he's really struggling to kind of convince people that there's a different route out there. But he was, you know, he's an unbelievably sunny personality. And I think there is something, if someone's going to convince people to take a different alternative and a different route, it's going to be someone like Mele.
I wanted to ask you something about a shark's DNA, because I mentioned Steve Palumbi,
right,
Stanford University professor, and his work. And is it fair to say that the DNA of a shark hasn't really evolved that much, hasn't really changed that much?
That's what Steve Palumbi argues, that basically if you look at a number of these lineages, that they're so ancient that they haven't had the same transformation and differentiation that you would see in other modern day creatures. And I think, you know, again, in some ways it just shows you that, you know, they evolved to a point and they were so successful that there wasn't this need for them to have the same level of variety as you might expect. But the downside to that is it could mean that they're, you know, they're more vulnerable because they're not, you know, it's unclear whether they can adapt to some of the changing pressures that they're facing right now.
801-585-WEST, the number. Let's go back to the phones. Michael is with us in Kanab, Utah. Michael, welcome.
Hey, thank you.
Sure.
Question about who's the top predator of the ocean. I've heard some people say that it's orcas, you know, killer whales, and others that it's great white sharks. And what's your expert take on that?
You get this question probably from time to time, Julie.
I do. Although sometimes if a child is asking it,
right,
they say, in a fight between an orca and a great white, who wins, you know?
Right.
So, right, that's often why I couch them as, say, one of the top predators. Because I think I would, you know, if there's one other predator that I would put up there with sharks, it would be orcas. It would be the killer whales. So I guess I would say I think it's hard and it would depend on the circumstances, but that usually, you know, I would say that they're among the top predators, and that the only real rival they have to that title would be the orca. That's what I'd say, if that helps.
If that helps, Michael. Thanks very much for the call. You know, I want to go back to this idea of the role of predators like orcas, and particularly sharks, of course,
sure,
on these ocean ecosystems. Because you write about going to the Northern Line Islands, the series of remote islands, and this one particular uninhabited reef, the Kingman Reef, which is incredibly remote. And it gives you a sense, you say, of what it's like for fish to be sheltered away from human beings.
Right. So it's so interesting because this, again, is an example of how our image of the ocean is in some ways defied by what we're learning about it. And so what's so interesting that there are, you know, several scientists who have conducted a few different expeditions to this area, the Line Islands. And what they found is you think of the pyramid where, oh, there are a few lions on top and then come the tigers, and, you know, and then you have more of the, you know, elk and, you know, things like that, antelope and so forth. And what's fascinating is they found that sharks, in terms of their biomass, vastly outnumbered the species below. And that's just completely contrary to what we think about in terms of nature. But of course, what we have to recognize is we've altered the oceans in ways that we're just beginning to grasp. And that's why they might not reflect our, you know, preconceived notions of what they should be like.
Mm. So, what is going to happen to turn the tide, the trend? I mean, you talk about in the book that we have a choice, but it's not going to be easy and it's not going to be pain-free. And it's going to have to take an incredible amount of global cooperation. What's it going to take, do you figure?
I think it's going to take, I mean, it's going to start with a reassessment of sharks, which I think that it's happening right now. That is what's really interesting. And you know, it might be happening a little more, for example, in the United States and Europe and some areas than, for example, in certain countries in Asia. But people are beginning to rethink what sharks are and why they matter. And so I think that's beginning to happen. And it is gathering some steam, even in places like, you know, like China, where they're consumed in greater numbers. And once that reassessment happens, then the question is ultimately a policy question, whether we are willing to forgo and restrict the kind of fishing practices that we have now, whether it's both consumption of shark fin soup or whether it's, you know, some of these industrial practices that are taking sharks in great numbers. Are we willing to give up some of that in order to make sure that sharks stick around? And that's, you know, again, that's a question that right now we're grappling with, and how it's answered remains a little unclear.
One of the people you talked to, Eric, is it Salas?
Enrique Salas.
Enrique Salas.
Yeah, exactly. Yes,
he says the way forward is if there's international officials imposed this worldwide indefinite moratorium on shark fishing, which seems just impossible. I mean, so how likely is something like that to happen?
I think that right now that's unlikely. Yeah. I think now that's a far cry off. They you know, international officials have difficulties even. There are only three shark species where you have prohibited trade: the great whites, the whale sharks, and basking sharks. So, you know, to get from that to a worldwide moratorium the way you have on most whale species, that's, you know, that's pretty tough. That said, I do think, you know, again, you know, it's going to be a combination of some policy measures imposed from the top down. And also, you know, for example, California, Washington, Oregon, and Hawaii have all voted to ban the sale, trade, possession of shark fins for shark fin soup. The bill hasn't been signed into law in California, but all of that has happened in the last year. So if all of that's happened in the last year, it does show you that people are willing to take some action on this front.
You feel hopeful?
I do, because I'm an optimist by nature. And I think it's also, it's just hard for me. You know, I've been so lucky that I've gotten in the water, you know, and been able to see these creatures, that I feel like it would be really depressing if I thought all was lost. So I'm going to bet on the, you know, even though I might bet on the orca, if it's between an orca and a great white, I'm going to bet on the shark in terms of long-term survival.
That's Juliet Eilprin, national environmental reporter for The Washington Post. Her book is called Demon Fish: Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. She joined us from the studios of The Washington Post in Washington. Juliet, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Tim Slover. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.